Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now, in-depth on entering a distant world. That distance was greater for the first novel that Jesse Burton wrote, The Miniaturist, which I loved. It was set in 17th century Amsterdam. But in her new novel, Miss Burton is still delving into a place and time well removed from the one she lives in now. The story moves between revolutionary Spain and 1960s London and follows the secret and serendipitous path of a work of art. And because Jesse Burton's novel takes us inside the creation of a painting in such vivid language, and we're going to talk about that, I thought it might be interesting to hear from you about a work of art that exerts a special pull on you. Maybe it's a painting, maybe it's a sculpture, a public mural. I think it'd be interesting context to our conversation. So as I talk with Jesse Burton about this novel that explores the act of creation of art, maybe there is a piece of art that kind of exerts a gravitational pull for you. And if you want to join in, love to hear about it. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can tweet me on it. Maybe you want to send me a photo of it via Twitter. That'd be fun. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Jesse Burton's new novel is titled The Muse, and she joins us this morning from Warwick, Rhode Island. Jesse, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again. Hello.
I've been so eager to talk to you about the perception and the language that you brought to the idea of the act of creation. I mean, I think when we stand in front of a work of art, and by that I mean a public mural, a paint, anything like that, we know, we recognize the power of it, but we don't know a lot about the force of the creation of it. And somehow you found a way to put that into language. How'd you do it?
That's the mystery itself, I think. It's the mystery of creation. I think it was something that I was very interested in investigating and examining, because it's something I do myself as a writer. I don't do it as a painter, so perhaps I've displaced the activity into another form of art. But yeah, it's a mystery, really. And a lot of it remains elusive, I think, even to the creator, even to the artist. And they don't quite know where the impulse comes from or how it's going to work out. But they just have to take this blind leap of faith into the darkness and hope that something good comes out of it.
Yeah, but the challenge for you was harnessing the force and the mystery of that into language. I know it's the work of the novelist. It's extraordinary work. I'm interested in how you thought about how you would describe it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose using language is something I've always done. I mean, it's the sort of best thing I can do with myself. And I mean, I always found it very enjoyable when I was writing The Muse to describe these paintings, to describe the moment of creation. So there's this artist in the book, Olive, and when she gets into this trance-like state and she's painting her pictures, but then also when other people are looking at them and what it makes them feel and how it makes them feel very different things depending on their own personalities. And I've had a lot of readers actually say, oh gosh, are these paintings real? Can I go and see them at the National Gallery? I feel terribly bad to let them down and say, unfortunately, no. They're fictional. They exist in a metaphysical world, not the real world. But maybe, I'm glad. I'm very grateful they think that.
Maybe that's your next career. Not that you need yet another one, but The Miniaturist had this idea of artistic sensibility. I mean, it was a different kind of art, but you were clearly drawn back to that. Is that right to say?
I think so. I think this whole idea in The Miniaturist that imagination can set you free, or using whatever powers of imagination you have to perhaps project a better world for yourself or for those around you or for the world in general, has transposed into The Muse. And I do think that the creative urge is extremely important in humankind, and to make art or to enjoy it. It sort of raises us above, and it's a kind of reflection of the best that we can be. But also how important it is to our well-being and how therapeutic it can be, or how it can help us explain ourselves. I couldn't do without it personally.
Yeah, to hear you say how important it is to explain ourselves, one of the things that I was conscious of as I was reading the way this story unfolded was how attached we are to the story of the artist. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and I've had the experience of seeing, for example, Giverny, and so I have this illusion probably that I better understand Monet because I've seen the Lily Pond. But sometimes mm-hmm. that's a distraction too, right?
Yeah.
From the power of the art. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by this attempt constantly for people to fuse together the artist with the artwork and this kind of obsession with the autobiography of an artist as if to further explain the artwork, whereas actually it could stand alone. And this kind of, I've experienced it, you know, I have a lot of people very interested in my personal life and what I think about this or that, and I just sometimes wish the novel or the novels I've written can be enough. And I don't know how much you can just kind of directly connect clues in an artist's life to their work, and whether you need to, because writing a novel is an ultimate act of imagination and escape as much as is often a presentation of an artificial reality. And so why are we trying to make the artist or the artist's personality part of the artwork that's going to be enjoyed anonymously? It's very interesting. And how much can I represent my work? You know, once it's out there, once my novel is being read by millions of people, I can't explain it anymore because somebody has taken it into their own minds. So I think it's quite an interesting one.
So this is fun to hear you talk about. This is your second novel.
Mm.
The conundrum of the, and you know, very experienced writers, I don't want to say complain, well, some of them do, about why isn't it enough? Why do I have to do the book tour? Why do I have to, you know, why do I have to talk to people like me, you know, as a reporter? Why doesn't the work stand on its own? And it's very true that knowing you better for whatever reason adds richness. And I don't mean knowing you in the personal sense. I mean knowing your creative expression principles adds richness to the experience of your work. I don't know why that should be. Do you?
I don't know either. I mean, and I'm guilty of it too. When I've got a novelist that I really admire or a musician or a film, I want to know about the actors in it. I want to know where they're from. I want to know where that musician grew up. But, you know, fundamentally, it shouldn't really affect my enjoyment of the work. Maybe it's just a human nature thing. Maybe we're just nosy. We're just naturally curious about the people who've made these things. But in the novel, I am exploring the freedom that can come if you're anonymous, if you hide behind another name, if you just are involved in the pure act of creation without having to be accountable for it, without having to represent it. And I do think that perhaps with the written word, novelists and writers are called upon to do more of this stuff than perhaps a visual artist. I mean, I can't really imagine Picasso going around doing an art tour, you know, standing in a gallery like next to Guernica or Les Demoiselles d'Avignon and saying, yes, and this is what I was going to do with this. But with novelists, perhaps because we are wordy, we're gonna do it. But I mean, I actually really do enjoy my tours and I love speaking to readers and I'm always fascinated to hear what they have to say about the books. But where it always pulls up short for me is where they ask me to explain the lives beyond the page, you know, the hinterland. Oh. And I just think, you do that. That's you complete that circle. You can do that for yourself. I've given you that gift. That's not my job. But people can be quite untrusting of their own instincts and their own enjoyment of a book, I think, and they want the author to complete that circle. But as far as I'm concerned, I've already done that with the novel and the last full stop.
I think, Jesse, that you are forever in danger of having to go out and explain your novels like Picasso did not have to do, because you're very good at this. I mean, and the best, by the way, the best conversations about novels, about fiction, for me, are not about, and then this happens, and this happens, and this, you know, where we're talking about characters and plot. The best, sure. The best conversations are about the big ideas that animate
totally.
Whatever creative expression, right, that you've come to.
Yeah, Yeah, I agree with you. And it's always gratifying to me when I get that opportunity to talk about the themes of my book rather than, you know, how I literally wrote the book. You know, I get that asked a lot. How do you write? Do you sit at a desk? I'm like, if you watched me write, you would be so bored. You would walk off within 15 minutes. It's so dull, you know. But I accept that, you know, for me, when I think of a painter painting a picture, I just think how mystical and incredible that you can do that. And I accept that there's a certain enigma surrounding it. But, you know, I don't sort of mince my words when I say that it's mainly graft and not much glamour.
So I tweeted out a question. Is there a work of art that exerts a gravitational pull on you? Tell me and show me. And Carl has tweeted, I've always been afraid, or Kari, I'm sorry, has tweeted, I've always been drawn to the vivid, saturated skies of Maxfield Parrish paintings. And she tweeted a photo. Thank you for that. Beautiful. Jim Stock just tweeted a number of different paintings here, including Michelangelo's David, and to the phones to Maggie in Woodbury. Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
Hey, hi.
I find it really interesting that you guys are talking about kind of explaining beyond having words. I had called in about Miriam Shapiro, and she's a performance artist, a very famous one. And she had a performance art at MoMA called The Artist is Present.
Uh-huh.
And she was just kind of sitting there, and people were allowed to come up and sit on the opposite side of the table from her. And they did not speak, and they were allowed to sit there as long as they wanted to, and they kind of just gazed into each other's eyes. So I kind of thought that that was, you know, the characters and the plots were able to speak for themselves without, you know, the words to be there for. And that definitely had a gravitational pull towards me. There's a great video of it online you can find.
So, Maggie, was she then creating art out of that, or that was the artistic moment, just having this connection with people that she didn't know across a table?
That was the artistic moment, and she actually had and this was thousands of people came to see her do this, and actually one of her former collaborators, Ule, he had surprised her and showed up as well, and they just had quite the moment, and it was beautiful.
Wow. Yeah. Hey, thank you for the call. That's a unique experience for us. To Callie in Minneapolis in the Twin Cities. Hi, Callie. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, who are you thinking about?
You know, I couldn't help but think about Drew Beeson. He's a local painter in Minnesota. And he does large abstract paintings, and I never really got into abstract work, but what struck me about his work was that it's so detailed that when I would look at it, I would find that I just couldn't stop looking at it. And after a while, it was almost like a personality would come through in the painting, almost like a character in a story. The more you looked at it, the more you felt like you got to know this character. And it became almost like a personal connection that you would have with this painting, with this abstract image.
Right.
Amazing.
And you guys were talking about how, you know, you want to meet the person who wrote the book or the artist who created the piece. And I met Drew Beeson, and I thought it was funny that asking him about his process didn't actually reveal anything about the paintings themselves.
Oh, really?
Huh. No, not really, but it gave me almost like an extra connection. I felt more connected to the piece simply because, almost as if I got to meet this character's father and experience the character on a different level. So I felt more connected to the piece, but yet I didn't get anything about more into the process, which didn't seem to really matter.
Oh, no. Really good call. What do you hear in that, Jesse?
Well, I mean, I'm quite gratified to hear that, because I do think that the process is ultimately so separate from the final product. You know, it's so funny to me when people sort of ask me, like, how do you do it? And I just think of all the moments or the months and the years of just lying horizontal in bed trying to write a book, or, you know, weeping at my desk. And then you get this beautiful book at the end of it that can be read in 3 days or whatever. And the process, I think, should remain in many ways is elusive to the person undertaking it, because as soon as I start analyzing where my impulses come from, how I'm going to do it and how and what's happening, I feel like I'm watching myself doing it, and then I become more self-conscious, and then the kind of instincts stop flowing. But it does seem to remain a fascination for people, like why or how this happens. But you know, I do think ultimately, once you've written a book several times and edited it and read it out loud, and it's kind of solidifying over time, the whole idea of the process starts slipping away, and the actual solid book replaces it. And then you forget. Like, I can't even really remember 2015 when I wrote The Muse. It was just like a complete absence of
the whole year.
I remember from about September, but January to September, there's a sort of blur of existence. I was elsewhere. I was absent. I was in 30 Spain.
Yeah. You were in that
London.
Distant world I was talking about in the introduction. I was just going to say, how lucky for you. I think that's a special place to be able to go to and live in for months on end.
Well, it can be quite dangerous because then you sort of forget to live in the real world. And it does seem sometimes when, you know, you're overwhelmed by it, you can't do both. You can't sort of look after yourself and you can't remember to eat well or dress or wash your hair because you're trying so much to get this world that's in your mind out onto the page. But it is a kind of privilege to have it, but it's a complicated one, I think.
I mean, did you feel like it sounds as if the undercurrent here is that it was a pleasurable place to retreat to, and it was hard to come back out of that when you needed to. Is that right?
Well, it's difficult because the pleasurable place is the fictional world, but actually the sort of transition into it and the attempt to kind of put that into this world is incredibly challenging for me and took its toll. You know, I was quite tired from the fallout of The Miniaturist. The Miniaturist was fairly successful globally and nobody was expecting that. And it took me a long time to catch up with that, you know, having something so privately made, so publicly consumed and dissected. And I was about to do it again. And, you know, the very act of writing, which had essentially changed my life and had given me so much success, was under threat by the very success it had created. And, you know, a pleasurable place for me at the time possibly was my bed under the covers or maybe watching some TV, not necessarily wrestling with my own imagination and my psyche and my emotions trying to get this book out. But, you know, once you're sort of done the first draft, I always feel happier because then there's actually physical material to play with and improve. It's the moments before that where it's just such a void and you don't know what's going to happen and whether you're going to pull this off. And it's, you know, it's just a void that gets filled with self-doubt. It's quite difficult.
So is the story here of what you call the fallout, which, I mean, has a negative connotation to it, but the reception, the wonderful reception of The Miniaturist, but is the story that the reality between what you thought was going to happen when you sent in the manuscript for The Miniaturist and they bought it and they published it, the reality of what really did happen and the space between what you thought was going to happen, that was quite disorienting, it sounds like.
Incredibly disorientating and destabilizing. Because as you say, when I said the words fallout, that makes it sound negative. Of course not. It was the best thing that's ever happened to me. It's changed my life irrevocably and so beneficently. You know, it's an incredible thing. But I wasn't expecting it. I was hoping to maybe get published in one country, i.e., you know, the UK, my own home country. I wasn't expecting nearly 40 countries. And you know, it one person's small dream to write a story and have people read it, which is essentially the nexus of what I do. That is it. That is what I do. I write stories. To have that exploded and to feel that you really can't catch up with it was really quite frightening at times, because I thought, what on earth have I done? You know, it was like I'd let the genie out of the lamp and I didn't know how to control it. It was just so much bigger than me, and I couldn't match its success. I couldn't perform that success. I couldn't be the girl living the dream. And that's, you know, it was like I'd created a monster, but a really benign monster that if only I could learn how to control it and have it on a little leash I'd be happier. And I, you know, over sort of 18 months, I've gradually learned how to do that and to take control of my talent, I guess.
I think this is so interesting because what our listeners may not know is that you come from an acting background. And so the idea of performance and expectation from an audience, whether that be in the theater or from readers, is not foreign to you.
No, no, it's not at all. I've been on stage since I was about 5 and professionally from aged 11. And then I did TV when I was around 15. And yeah, I mean, I was a professional actress, mainly theatre acting. And when I do write my books, I'm thinking, initially I write for myself. I think you have to write quite selfishly first time round. You know, you can't think of an invisible committee of readers, otherwise you'd go mad. You just write the story you want to tell. But then when I start editing, I read it out loud and I imagine an audience and I imagine, am I transmitting this story satisfactorily for someone who's a bit tired at the end of the day? And but even so, it's such a private thing, writing a story, you know, compared to acting, which is communal and collaborative and very public. So having a book kind of exploded like that, even though I am comfortable on a stage in front of an anonymous mass of people, I wasn't quite ready for quite how odd it was to feel successful and to feel accepted, because I'd spent my life as an actress so used to rejection. And that, you know, we all know it. It's a job that you just get rejected more than accepted.
Weird. The reason that question came into my mind was what you said about I couldn't be the girl living the dream. And what I think you're saying is we have a certain expectation of what that looks like. And you had experience with putting on, you know, a kind of another identity. And and this idea that there was, you just couldn't reconcile the world expects that this is what it looks like when you're the girl living the dream. And I just couldn't act and be and, you know, live in that.
No. And that's partly because, you know, when you're an actress, you're playing a role. You have got somebody else's lines. But when you're a writer and you're a public writer, and I was very public, you are yourself as much as you can be, and there are no lines, and it is your life, and you're being analysed and scrutinised. And I think we have these ideas of success and goals to get us out of bed in the morning, to define ourselves, to self-identify like what we want to be and what we're going to do and how we're going to get there. You get there, as I got there, which I wasn't expecting to, in a major way. It was like an exhaustion of arrival. I'd sort of run out of energy. You know, I've been fighting for this all my life. And you know, suddenly everything I thought I was, my identity basically fragmented, because there was no Jesse left, if you like, to cope with this international best-selling fame. And that was quite a weird one. And I just kept trying to remember why I was doing it. And it was because I like writing. It's very fundamental.
Jesse Burton is with us. If you've just tuned in, her last novel, and we talked with her when that came out, was called The Miniaturist. I love it. And The Muse is wonderful. And we're talking about the ideas that that she was delving into around creative expression and why we are devoted maybe, to the idea of knowing the biography of the artist and what happens when you separate that. I also want to talk to her about a sense that I had that the language in The Miniaturist was a bit more austere. I felt like Jesse was giving us a little more lushness. Well, she can tell us whether that's true or not. And then I want to hear from you as we talk about creative and artistic expression, if there's a piece of art that exerts, and it can be performance art, sculpture, painting, you name it, that exerts a kind of gravitational pull on you. And tell me why that is. 651-227-6000. You can tell me and show me on Twitter. I love all these paintings and sculptures and the busts of people that are showing up on my Twitter feed. So keep it coming. It's at Carrie NPR. Steph, something off the page.
Yes.
You would need the
microphone.
I
need
there.
The microphone. Yeah. That was my fault. JT says, I have an artist whose work moves me. That's Vincent van Gogh. I read his biography, although I don't have his struggles, much less his talent. I can relate to not being a part of a group, and I have a better appreciation of the struggles that he puts into his brushstrokes. And I posted the video of Marina Abramović at her installation where the artist is present.
Is that who our caller?
Yes,
Marina Abramović. I think we had the name wrong there, but good.
But
hey, I'll retweet that.
NPRnews.org/live.
Jesse continues with us. We'll get a look at the latest news. And Phil, what are you watching?
Hi, Carrie. A Washington, D.C. transit police officer has been charged in an FBI sting with attempting to support the Islamic State group. The FBI says he is the first law enforcement officer in the U.S. to be charged with a terror-related crime. Court documents say 36-year-old Nicholas Young of Fairfax, Virginia, was arrested this morning. According to an affidavit, he bought nearly $250 in gift cards that he intended for the Islamic State to use to purchase mobile apps. But Young actually gave the gift cards to an undercover FBI source. Documents show Young has been under surveillance since 2010, and he traveled to Libya twice in 2011. Alabama's parole board has decided against freeing a one-time Ku Klux Klansman convicted in a church bombing that killed four black girls more than 50 years ago. The decision to keep 76-year-old Thomas Blanton imprisoned was met with applause at the hearing. Blanton is the last surviving KKK member convicted of murder in the bombing of Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church back in 1963. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is withholding his endorsement of fellow Republicans House Speaker Paul Ryan and Arizona Senator John McCain in their reelection bids. And Trump is getting some heat for that, but he insists there is great unity in his own campaign. He tweeted today that campaign unity is perhaps greater than ever before. And Venus and Serena Williams have arrived in Rio for the Summer Olympics. The two-time defending Olympic women's doubles gold medalists got their accreditations processed after flying in this morning. The sisters have a combined 8 gold medals between them, 4 apiece. They teamed up for doubles gold in 2000, 2008, and 2012. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:41.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, I'll speak with Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto about her department giving all officers body cameras. How will the cameras affect calls for reformed policing in this country? We discuss at 11.
Programming supported by The Guthrie, presenting Disgraced. With a provocative and fiery script, Disgraced has been described as a blistering social drama about racial prejudices, now through August 28th. Tickets and information at GuthrieTheater.org.
By the way, I'm seeing Disgraced at The Guthrie on Friday, and there will be a Friday roundtable about it next week. Seeing it this Friday, Friday roundtable about it next week. So I hope you'll tune in for that. Also want to let you know that the books that the next president should read is a huge show. Lots of people downloading that. If you want to hear it, because I get a lot of emails about what was on that list, you can find it in the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes. Back to this discussion, Jesse Burton's The Muse is part of our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series. Read all about it on the thread, and the thread question coming up here a little later. But Jesse continues our conversation. Before I get into this, the language, I just have to say, I mean, you, I can see why this kind of felt like climbing a mountain to bring this novel through, Jesse, because, I mean, you've taken on race and class and gender and social mobility all in a way that is very... subtle's not really the right word. Does a word come to mind for you?
surprisingly, given that I'm a novelist, I'm slightly stuck to describe it.
Do you know what I mean when I say
it? I kind of get what you're saying, because it's like these things are huge, broad landscapes compared to the slight claustrophobia and, you know, focused world of the miniaturist. You know, here we've got 30s Spain with rise of nationalism and hate crime and civil war, and then 60s London with the legacy of British colonialism and then the whole meaning of art.
Yes.
And I've shoved it all into one book. But, you know, I'm nothing if not ambitious, clearly, but slightly madly ambitious. And I don't think about it like that, really, when I'm doing it. It's just what interests me. And I'm, you know, trying to work out a way that I can make that into a beautiful synthesized whole. And without sort of whacking the reader around the head with all my sort of interests. You know, for me, story is king. So if you can make sure you channel these interests through the characters and their lives, then you can be a bit more insidious about it, I suppose.
But I mean, it was a definite choice for you to choose that character in 1960s London and her friend would come from the Caribbean and would confront perceptions about young, black women out of the Caribbean in that era of London. I mean, you did that deliberately, of course.
Yeah, it's a mixture, though. I always say, yes, obviously, to some point, it must have been deliberate. But for me, Adele was always Trinidadian. And so it's this weird thing again, you know, where do you get your ideas from? Where does this girl appear from in my mind's eye, you know, indubitably from the Caribbean? And I can say, well, I can look back at my own academic interest in the legacy of British colonialism and how that is lived out on the streets of London in 1960s, how Britain is so interconnected with the Caribbean because of our wealth built on slavery and sugar and tobacco and cotton and all of these things. But also, you know, Adele is Adele. That's her name, Adele Bastian. Yes, she is black. She's from the Caribbean, but she's also a woman. She also wants to be a writer. She also complains about the lack of makeup in the department stores. She falls in love. She's prim. She can be difficult. You know, I wanted to create this entire person. But nevertheless, obviously, as a white woman myself, I was very conscious of the need to make sure that when Adele speaks to her best friend, Cynthia, and they talk in their patois, that I got that as accurately as I could. And I had a contact at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad who went through it all for me. And she is the same age as Adele would be if Adele were a real person and was in London in the 60s. So, yeah, I mean, I was very interested in that. But also, you know, London at that time, and London always has been massively multicultural. And I think it's very important to remember who it is who writes history, who's the dominant voice writing the kind of often quite patriarchal, often quite white histories in the Western world. And these people were there. It's just that their voices were not so loud. So, yes, there was a political deliberate element, but there was also a massively holistic and organic element to the creation of Adele Bastian.
So what you've just said then leads me to believe that your language and your choice of words and even the length of the sentences that you employed in this novel felt like they responded to the places in which they were set, the vividness of the color and the landscapes, in a way that I think was different in The Miniaturist, which was a much more austere kind of landscape that you were writing into. Is there anything to this?
Well, that's incredibly generous of you to say that. I like the idea of the language matching the setting very much. You know, what comes first, chicken or egg? But I think with the Miniaturist, it's interesting you say austere, because a lot of readers and critics have said, you know, it felt very intense and jeweled and dense, because they were in this quite Calvinistic, quite strict atmosphere, but there was this urge to ostentation and indulgence and sugar and velvets. And and actually, I strived more with the muse for a slightly more fluid, lighter tone, more muscular, if you like. And I was reading a lot of nonfiction at the time when I was writing it. And, you know, I was 27 when I started The Miniaturist, and I was 33 when I finished The Muse. So I'd hope that there's been some development of skill and trajectory of kind of style. But I think I was aware that with The Miniaturist, we were setting it in damp, misty canals of 17th century Amsterdam, and The Muse is set in summer in Spain, you know, hot and bright and bleached white walls and drowsy bees flying around. And then London in 67 is in the summer too, and everyone's sweating and complaining about the heat, as Londoners are wont to do. So, yeah, I think there was a conscious maybe a boldness in the way that I attacked the style of the language in The Muse compared to The Miniaturist.
Yeah, I mean, I have the copy of The Miniaturist from our first conversation, and I opened it and you know, skimmed through to see even length of sentences. I felt like you let yourself stretch more because you could, you know, because the landscape and the vividness of what the characters were of the artistic expression lent itself to that. I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking too analytically about this.
No, I don't think you are. And I think it's always very exciting when you are a writer yourself to write a writer. So to write my book, The Muse, is through the voice of Adele Bastian, who is a writer. Mm-hmm. And she is an established writer talking to us about her youth. And so you get a certain freedom of expression and unapologetic lyricism or insight or sharpness that, you know, perhaps if you were maybe a lesser verbal character, you might not be able to do. And it's like one of my favorite novels is Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner, and that's through the voice of a writer, and you can tell that Anita Bruckner is having so much fun using her narrator as a mouthpiece, and I did the same, you know. Mm-hmm. Because then you can really play it, you can go on your meta layers of role play.
Yeah, you're quite interested in the idea of the story within the story within the story, huh?
Definitely. And actually, the opening scene of The Muse is a story that my own mother told me when she was working in a shoe shop aged 16 in London. This woman came in and said, "Oh, I just don't care what size shoe." And my mum was like, "What?" to herself. And then the woman took off her shoes and she had no toes. And she said, "Any size will do." And I didn't tell my mum this, but I used that story as the opening scene for The Muse. And so when she read
it... You sure did.
I did. And so this is it, you know. We're magpies and we're like recalibrating, reconfiguring people and scenes and memories into this strange parallel world of fiction. And that's what I like playing with. And yes, within The Muse, storytelling and using the painting, for example, to trigger writing and kind of creating more creativity is very important to me. It's that kind of collaborative mirroring.
What kind of a life did your mother lead in 1960s London?
Well, it was, I think, both of my parents, they were born in the war, actually. They were born in the Blitz, so they're in their 70s now.
Wow.
And they grew up in South London, where the book is set, and they always said to me, "Oh, Jess, you know, everyone thought it was swinging 60s, blah, blah, blah. But most of us were working as hard as we could. We were all broke because the war had bankrupted Britain, and 50s were grey and austere, and 60s was kind of not much better." Obviously, there was an explosion of culture and then counterculture. But yeah, they worked bloody hard, actually. And that's kind of, you know, what I'm trying to transmit in this novel as well, that, you know, people were workers and trying to make their way. And obviously with like little flares of joy and music and passion.
Little flares of joy, huh?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the book is full of that. But yeah, it's quite funny actually to set it in my home turf, really.
I want to ask you the question that I've been asking our audience today, which is the work of art that really exerts that kind of gravitational pull on you. What would it be?
Where do I start? Where do I begin? I mean, I love the Bellini paintings. There's a painting actually at the Frick in New York called St. Francis by Bellini, and it's one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. And I think for me it matches many things, the narrative curiosity, but also the colour scheme is so trippy and unusual, and you think when he was painting it, and the size of it and the kind of messages behind it, that's one for me. I love Frida Kahlo's work. I love early Miro. I love work by Louise Bourgeois, Sonia Delaunay. They're the ones that sort of spring to mind right now. I don't have any one particular favourite painting, but, you know, I'm quite hungry for colour often and surrealism.
That was a really good answer to where to start. Where do I even start?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's like being asked, what's your favourite book? But, you know, obviously there are so many paintings which arrest you and you just think, my goodness. And then you think about when they were painted and who else was painting at the same time. Like, you look at a Holbein portrait of Thomas Cromwell, and you just think, how was he doing that? You know, you feel like Cromwell's going to turn around and look at you and speak to you.
Jesse, we're closing with Laura Marling's The Muse. So enjoy.
Oh,
and thank you. Thank you so
My pleasure.
Much.